Welcome back to Chapter and Verse. This is episode 5 of our discussion about the Sabbath. What is Shabbat exactly? What are the commands concerning Shabbat? How would we apply those commands to our 21st century lives? In the last episode, we looked at what Isaiah chapter 66, Jeremiah chapter 17, and Matthew chapter 12 had to say about this topic. Within that discussion, we talked about some principles that we could extrapolate out from the commands concerning Shabbat. We also looked at some ways in which man has gone to some extremes in certain cases, attempting to justify the adding of multiple extraneous commands in addition to the commands found in Scripture. For this episode, we'll continue our journey through the Bible, examining what it has to say on the topic of Shabbat. In this episode, we'll pick up where we left off in our last episode, in the Gospel of Matthew. In our previous episode, we read from chapter 12. In this episode, we'll start with an interesting statement Yeshua made in chapter 24. Before we read that passage, let's talk a little bit about Matthew chapter 24. This has been one of the most cited and, honestly, most abused chapters in the Bible over the course of the last half century. Matthew chapter 24 is the infamous end times chapter. The theme of this chapter gets kicked off in verse 3, where Yeshua's disciples ask the question, "Tell us, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" The rest of the chapter is Yeshua's answer to that question. Chances are, I don't even need to read you his response. Most of you can quote certain parts from memory, primarily because it's been drilled into your heads by Bible teachers over and over and over for the last 50 years. Chances are, you can say the following phrases along with me, nearly verbatim. "You will be hearing rumors of wars. Nations will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes." Do those things sound familiar? I've heard dozens of Bible teachers, messianic and Christian alike, beat the drum of Matthew 24, saying that these things are happening now, all over the world. So clearly we're at the end, right? Now, I'm not attempting to burst anyone's eschatological bubbles. But all those things have been happening for the last 2,000 years. Mankind makes war. The earth has cycles. Droughts happen, which lead to famine. Diseases spread death. Earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes, blizzards, heat waves, and all the other meteorological events have always happened, and they continue to do so today. Are they increasing in frequency in these days? From our perspectives, perhaps. But that's primarily because we have much better recording and measuring techniques today than we did even 100 years ago. But lest I belabor this point, I don't need to, because Yeshua's next words already answer the question. He says in verse 8, "But all these things are merely the beginning of birth pangs." In other words, all those things that we just mentioned, they're simply the precursors to what comes next. They indicate to us that something bigger is coming, but they're not the end in and of themselves. In Matthew chapter 24, verses 15 through 21, however, Yeshua describes the events that do signal the end. He says, beginning in verse 15, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken about through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. Whoever is on the housetop must not go down to get the things out that are in his house. Whoever is in the field must not turn back to get his cloak. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. But pray that your flight will not be in winter or on a Sabbath. For then there will be a great tribulation, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will." Obviously, there's a lot we could say about this passage and the things that it points to. But this program is not focused on eschatology, so we'll leave that to others to comment on. But there is a reason that we looked at this passage. Yeshua described a situation here that is obviously very tense and terrifying. So terrifying, in fact, that he says that it's the greatest tribulation that has ever or will ever occur. That paints a pretty frightening picture. According to this warning from Messiah, this occurrence that Daniel spoke of is so serious and so frightening that you are to immediately drop absolutely everything and flee. You shouldn't go in your house and grab something. You shouldn't even grab a suitcase with extra clothing for your trip. Do not pass go. Do not collect $100. Just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. Skedaddle pronto. Hightail it out of town. Head for the hills. Literally. Now, I'm having fun with this because, at the moment, I can. But the description that's given here is very serious. So let me address this more appropriately. This scenario is so serious that Yeshua warns us that fleeing immediately is more important than anything else. Now, the context here is specifically for those who are in Judea. But that's another topic for another time. In any event, this event is so frightening that Yeshua states that nursing and pregnant women will be unlikely to survive. A mother of small children or one who is pregnant would be less likely to be able to instantly flee with haste. Other factors would hinder their flight. The implication here is that when this event takes place, if you're in Judea, you are to sprint out of town and hide in the hills surrounding Jerusalem. Obviously, that would be difficult for women in this position to do. But then it gets really interesting. Yeshua says in verse 20, pray that your flight will not be in the winter or on a Sabbath. Why would Yeshua have said this? I mean, it's understandable that nursing and pregnant women would be at risk in the description of immediate flight. But why would we be concerned if this flight takes place in the winter or on Shabbat? In order to understand why Yeshua would say this, we need to understand the context of the warning that Yeshua gives. Specifically, we're going to look at verses 17 and 18, which say, whoever is on the housetop must not go down to get the things out that are in his house. Whoever is in the field must not turn back to get his cloak. Obviously, if it is wintertime and you see this abomination take place, and Yeshua warns you not to go into your home to get anything, including your cloak, you're going to end up being ill-prepared to survive the cold of the winter. And if you're fleeing to the mountains, which verse 15 specifically says to do, it will be even colder on the mountains than it would be down below where most towns are located. Especially because if you flee to the mountains, you'll end up likely seeking out shelter in a cave. That cave is going to be even colder because the sunlight doesn't shine directly into it. So if this flight takes place in the winter, and you immediately flee without any provisions, you might be in danger of freezing. Obviously, there's no ideal time to flee in this manner, but wintertime for sure would be the worst-case scenario. So we can understand, then, why Yeshua would say, pray that your flight will not be in the winter. I mean, that makes sense. But what about, or on a Sabbath? What about that part? By the way, did you notice what the very next words are in this passage? For then there will be a great tribulation, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will. Most of us, upon reading verse 21, make the assumption that this is an overview statement. In other words, most of us, whether intentionally or unintentionally, end up interpreting verse 21 to be in regards to the entire context of chapter 24. To put it another way, when reading verse 21, most of us assume that this description in verse 21 about how great the tribulation will be, it's speaking about all the other things spoken about in the preceding verses, including the earthquakes and the famines and everything else. But what if verse 21 is much more specific than that? What if verse 21 is referring specifically to the previous two verses only, the ones bemoaning pregnant and nursing mothers and fleeing during winter or on a Sabbath? What if the reference to the tribulation that will be greater than any ever seen is in regard specifically to the flight taking place in winter or on a Shabbat? Based upon the factors we just discussed, we would potentially understand why fleeing in wintertime would prove to be very dangerous. But why would the flight happening on a Sabbath be included in this description? This is where we need some other scripture references as well as some cultural context in order to comprehend this warning. Up to this point in this program, in the last four episodes, we've worked our way through the Bible looking at verses about Shabbat by the order in which they appear in Scripture. But we're about to depart from that pattern. The next verse that appears about Shabbat that we will discuss comes from Luke chapter 4. But we're not going to get to that right here. We'll discuss that passage in a few minutes. But right now, we're going to first look at Acts chapter 1 for a clue we are given that will help shed some light on this topic, on why a flight on Shabbat would be considered so unfavorable. We see in Acts chapter 1, verse 12, this statement about the disciples, who were remaining in Jerusalem after the ascension of Yeshua. In verses 9 through 11, it describes the ascension that took place on the Mount of Olives. Then, in verse 12, it says, "Then they returned to Jerusalem from the Mount of Olivet, which is near Jerusalem, a Sabbath day's journey away." A Sabbath day's journey away? What does that mean? A Sabbath day's journey is a reference to a principle that was developed in the Second Temple period. It was determined, based upon several biblical proofs, that one should not journey far from one's home on Shabbat. This is based upon a text that we've already looked at back in episode 1. That verse comes from Exodus chapter 16. If you will recall from episode 1, when the concept of Shabbat was introduced to the children of Israel, this command was given by Adonai in Exodus chapter 16, verse 29, where it says, "See, Adonai has given you the Shabbat. Therefore he gives you bread for 2 days on the sixth day. Remain every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day." We briefly discussed this passage in episode 1, but we're going to get into a bit more detail here. So, we see the command, "every man stay in his place." Does this mean that we should all stay home on Shabbat? I mean, that's what this verse seems to say, right? On the surface, yes. But if you'll recall from the last episode, in episode 4, we discussed the principle of kal v'chomer, which literally means easy and hard, or light and heavy. This phrase communicates that when there are two opposing views or conflicting verses, the one that carries more weight, or the heavier result, is the one that takes priority. Another way to view this is positive versus negative. To explain in simpler terms, if there's a positive commandment, such as to love your neighbor as yourself, if that positive commandment is seemingly conflicting with a negative commandment, such as do no work on the Sabbath, then the positive commandment is the one that you should follow, even at the expense of the negative one. In this particular scenario, the positive commandment is from Leviticus chapter 23, verse 3. In that verse, as we discussed in episode 1, it says, "For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day there is a Shabbat of complete rest, a Mikra Kodesh, a holy convocation." In a previous episode, we discussed the importance of the Mikra Kodesh and how gathering together is an essential part of fulfilling the instructions concerning Shabbat. But how can you fulfill the commandment to have a holy convocation if you're remaining in your place by staying in your home? In this scenario, the positive commandment, have a Mikra Kodesh, outweighs the negative commandment of stay in your place. As a result, in order to harmonize these two seemingly opposing commands, a principle unfolded in the Second Temple period called a Sabbath day's journey. If the building where your fellow like-minded believers were gathering, such as the local synagogue, if it was in the next neighborhood over or a few blocks away, how could one attend that meeting if you couldn't leave your home? Because gathering with your brothers and sisters was the more important of the two commands, it was decided that travel to synagogue on Shabbat was allowable. This is why we see examples in the Gospels of Yeshua attending the local synagogues on Shabbat. But of course, once you open up Pandora's box, it's awfully hard to close it again. Questions naturally arose concerning this topic. If I can travel to the synagogue, can I then also travel to my friend's house? What if he lives in another town? Questions like these arose. In order to avoid chaos, it was determined by the spiritual leadership of the nation of Israel in the post-Maccabean revolt era that parameters would be placed upon the distance one was allowed to travel on Shabbat. It was decided that one could travel on Shabbat no more than 2,000 cubits from your home. Why 2,000 cubits? Well, this was based upon two different verses in Scripture. The first was Numbers chapter 35, verse 5, which discusses the area around a city that belonged to the Levites. It says there, "You shall also measure outside the city on the east side 2,000 cubits, and on the south side 2,000 cubits, and on the west side 2,000 cubits, and on the north side 2,000 cubits, with the city in the center. This shall become theirs as pasture lands for the cities." So here in Numbers chapter 35, we have a definition of the Levitical lands given that extends no further than 2,000 cubits from the city's walls. How far exactly is 2,000 cubits? Well, a cubit is a measurement that varies according to which source you're referring to, but it's generally considered to be the distance between the fingertip to the elbow, which is roughly about 18 inches in most cases. It was assumed in biblical times that a cubit also corresponded to the typical step. As our population has grown taller over the last several thousand years, the current step length today is closer to 30 inches instead of 18 inches, but 2,000 plus years ago, a cubit was often measured by the length of one's normal step. Thus, 2,000 cubits would equate to roughly 2,000 steps. So it became practice in the Second Temple period to say that one could travel up to 2,000 steps from one's home on Shabbat without breaking the instruction to stay in one's place. This was further substantiated by the passage in Joshua chapter 3, verses 3 and 4, which says, "When you see the Ark of the Covenant of Adonai your Elohim with the Levitical priests carrying it, then you shall set out from your place and go after it. However, there shall be between you and it a distance of about 2,000 cubits by measure. Do not come near it, that you may know the way by which you shall go, for you have not passed this way before." So, this passage from Joshua mentions 2,000 cubits was the distance to be kept between the Ark and the camp of the Israelites while they traveled together during their conquest of the land of Israel. This was then combined with the passage from Numbers that we read, which provides the basis upon which this principle of a Sabbath day's journey was created. It was deemed that the city one lived within was one's makom, or place, that is mentioned in Exodus chapter 16, verse 29, and that it was not just specific to your home, but to the city that you lived in. Thus, according to this line of thought, it was justifiable to walk around within one's own city, but you couldn't travel outside your city more than 2,000 cubits. This then allowed one to walk to synagogue on Shabbat, as there would have been at least one synagogue in every town. Now, there are clear holes in logic that can be punched in this principle, if we wanted to. For instance, in the book of Job, it's said that the city of Nineveh took Job 3 full days to traverse across. Obviously, it would be kind of ridiculous to say that the entire city was still within a Sabbath day's journey, given the fact that it took him 3 days to cross it. That would really be stretching the limits to the intent behind the principle. But back to the point, as we discussed in an earlier episode, when Yeshua and his disciples are walking on Shabbat in Matthew chapter 12, and they come to a grain field and pluck some of the wheat to eat, they're not challenged about walking on Shabbat, but about the plucking of the grain. It was acceptable to be found walking on Shabbat, just not doing anything else that could be considered to be work. The original intent of this principle of a Sabbath day's journey was to allow one to be able to attend synagogue, to visit with friends, and to enjoy a leisurely, peaceful Shabbat, but also to act as a restriction against extraneous travel. It was also designed to act as an anchor for the Sabbath keeper, to keep them close to the gathering place of worship so that they were empowered to fulfill the Mikra Kodesh, the holy convocation, with their brothers and sisters. Now, I won't get into the whole circumventions conversation, as that conversation won't bear any fruit in our current discussion, but let's just say that through the course of history, man has shown his cleverness in coming up with ways to bend, if not break, every command found within Scripture. If one examines the Talmud, one will find many additional exceptions that were allowed that permitted travel up to 2 to 3 times as far as the 2,000 cubits did. But back to the point where we began this conversation, we see the disciples in Acts chapter 1 and a reference to the Mount of Olives being within a Sabbath day's journey. If measured from the Temple Mount, the Mount of Olives is about 3 kilometers, which is just under 2 miles. This would be farther than a Sabbath day's journey, if that were the starting point. But if we recall, the measurement is done from the city walls, just as the Levites' lands were measured. In fact, from where the city walls of Jerusalem stood, the Mount of Olives would only be about 8/10 of a kilometer, or about 1/2 mile away. This would have been right around 1,800 cubits from the city walls of Jerusalem. Thus, the Mount of Olives was indeed a Sabbath day's journey from Jerusalem, as the book of Acts records for us. So now that we have discussed the technicalities of what a Sabbath day's journey is and what its purpose was, let's now ask the question that should be staring us right in the face. Did Yeshua and or the disciples adhere to this man-made principle? I mean, there's no direct command in Scripture that speaks of a Sabbath day's journey. So is this something the first century church practiced? Well, unfortunately, there appears to be very little to no information to answer this question outside of the reference in Acts chapter 1. To my knowledge, there aren't any extra-biblical texts that either confirm or deny that the first century church practiced this principle. But the fact that Luke, the author of the book of Acts, decided to put this little tidbit of information in the opening chapter of the book of Acts indicates that it was potentially something that the disciples adhered to. This is especially telling because Luke was most likely, according to almost all Bible scholars, of Greek lineage. Why would someone who was born Greek make mention of an extra-biblical rabbinic practice if it wasn't contextually appropriate? That little bit of info doesn't add any additional meaning to the story, unless it is something that the disciples were accustomed to practicing. So if this was something that the first century church practiced on a regular basis, what should that mean to us? Most of us don't walk very far anymore. Most of us don't live within walled cities. How could we practice this principle in our 21st century context? This is a long conversation, primarily because there's no direct command to be found in Scripture about this topic. Okay, now that we have the disclaimer out of the way, what I'm about to share with you is how I personally view this topic. Not everyone here at the ministry would agree with me on this, and that's okay. Again, it's not commanded. So if you disagree with me, that's okay too. This is just the way that I see things based upon the biblical text, the context of these passages, and from my own personal experience. So in today's world, we generally live in cities and areas that are fairly spread out. Most of us don't walk to local fellowships. Instead, most of us drive there. Now, we discussed in a previous episode about how the most rigid branches of Judaism claim that if you start your car on Shabbat, that is to kindle a fire within your spark plugs and within your pistons. Thus, they don't drive on Shabbat. Instead, they make a point of establishing a synagogue within walking distance of everyone's homes. Thus, in most Jewish communities, there are often multiple synagogues. Not because they disagree with each other like differing denominations, but because they are geographically planned out to be within walking distance of the entire community. So, as an example, there would be a synagogue on the east end of town and one on the west end, so that everyone in town was close enough to a synagogue to stay within the Sabbath day's journey when traveling to a Sabbath service. But for most of us, finding a local fellowship can be a challenge. And very few, if any of us, live in an area where we can walk to fellowship. So, as a result, most of us drive to meet with others and fulfill the Mikra Kodesh, the holy convocation of the Sabbath. Is this a violation of the principle of a Sabbath day's journey? I don't think so. Why do I say that? Because walking can become a tiresome event. For some, especially those with physical challenges, walking even a mile, a half mile there and a half mile back, could prove to be very difficult. But most of us can get into and out of a vehicle fairly easily without exerting too much effort. Thus, in my family, we've adopted a principle. The principle is that we will not travel on Shabbat unless we are traveling for the purpose of meeting with other believers for fellowship. There are occasional exceptions to this principle. For instance, when we happen to be on vacation. Sometimes even household rules end up getting temporarily tossed out when you're out of your normal routine. For me and my house, one of those times happens to be vacation. We still try our best to stick with our family principles in those circumstances and honor Shabbat to the best of our ability, but we also remain flexible enough to adjust if the situation requires it. But when we aren't on vacation, during normal circumstances, we stick to the principle that we do not travel for pleasure or for any frivolous pursuit on Shabbat. Shabbat is to be a day that's devoted to Him. We are to be focused on resting, ceasing from labor, and fellowshipping with other like-minded believers. So in our family, as a general rule, we don't travel anywhere on Shabbat unless it's for the purpose of fellowship. That said, there's a flip side to this coin. Our family has also developed the principle that there are no limits, within reason that is, to the distance that we are willing to travel on Shabbat in order to fellowship with others. What I mean by that is that we have no problem with driving 3 hours on Shabbat to attend fellowship with others. As an example, I pastor a fellowship in Oklahoma City, but we have some sister congregations as well. One of those sister congregations is in the Dallas area, which is 3 hours away. Our services in Oklahoma City are in the morning, and the services in Dallas are in the afternoon. There are times when I'm put on the schedule to speak in the Dallas Fellowship. I willingly and gladly drive to Dallas on Shabbat, in that scenario only, because I'm doing so in order to serve others, to fellowship with others, and to encourage others in Adonai. That type of scenario is definitely in violation of the principle of a Sabbath day's journey. But there are other factors involved that, to me, creates another Kal V'chomer scenario. It's another example, in my opinion, of a positive command, encouraging the brethren in their most holy faith, that is greater than the command to stay in one's place. And as previously mentioned, it's not physically taxing for me and my family to hop in a car for a 3-hour drive. The marvels of modern technology have certainly changed the world we live in, which is both a blessing and a curse. The blessing is that we are now, more than at any other time in history, able to meet with and encourage one another with relative ease. We're able to cross great distances in very short periods of time. Yet the result of some of those same advancements has produced laziness within us. Few of us walk anywhere anymore. Okay, so now that we've gotten my personal interpretation out of the way, there's another topic that's along these lines that we should address at this point. What are we to say about conferences and functions that take place over the weekend at hotels and other large facilities? How do we harmonize that scenario with the instructions concerning Shabbat? Let's take, for example, our Shavuot conference. Lion & Lamb typically puts on a large Shavuot conference every year. It's a wonderful time of gathering with like-minded believers from around the U.S. and the world in some cases, in order to fulfill the command to have a Mikra Kodesh, a holy convocation, at Shavuot, or Pentecost. Leviticus 23:21 states that we are to make a proclamation and have a holy convocation at this festival. So, traditionally, Lion & Lamb has hosted a large gathering at that time, inviting anyone who would like to attend to join us in that celebration. We have multiple speakers, we have youth and kids programs, we have multiple worship teams, and we have an all-around fantastic time over the course of a 3-day weekend, Friday through Sunday. Of late, we've been holding this event in a large hotel that's capable of holding an event that can seat the several hundred people that attend this event as well as give them a place to sleep. Ultimately, however, there are always people who question us and criticize us for holding an event over the weekend in a hotel. After all, we're staying in a hotel on Shabbat. There's a staff that's working there on Shabbat, serving us collectively together. We're paying for the hotel rooms as well as the conference rooms. All of this appears to be in violation of the commands concerning Shabbat, right? That position, however, is an example of the proverbial phrase, missing the forest for the trees. You see, Shavuot requires a Mikra Kodesh. How does one carry that out? Should we forsake the assembling of believers? Should we ignore that command so that we can honor the commands about Shabbat that we've discussed in this program? If not, then how should we go about fulfilling the command at Shavuot to have a holy convocation? Keep in mind that the context of the commands concerning Shavuot is that all the men, at a minimum, were to gather together in Jerusalem for this festival. We see this in Exodus chapter 23, verse 14 through 17, and repeated in Exodus chapter 34, verses 22 and 23. There it says, 3 times a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. You shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread. For 7 days you are to eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you, at the appointed time in the month of Aviv, for in it you came out of Egypt. And none shall appear before me empty-handed. Also you shall observe the Feast of the Harvest of the Firstfruits of your labors from what you sow in the field. Also the Feast of the Ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather in the fruit of your labors from the field. 3 times a year all your males shall appear before Adonai Elohim. Now, the Feast of the Harvest of the Firstfruits that's mentioned there, it's a reference to Shavuot, which takes place in the early summer, at the time of the harvest of the wheat crop. Lest we dispute that correlation, Exodus 34 clears it up for us in verses 22 and 23, where it says, "You shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks, that is, the firstfruits of the wheat harvest, and the Feast of Ingathering at the turn of the year. 3 times a year, all your males are to appear before Adonai Elohim, the Elohim of Israel." Lest anyone dispute that the phrase Feast of Weeks in verse 22 is not in reference to Shavuot or Pentecost, the Hebrew in verse 22 reads V'chag Shavuot Ta'aseh, which means, "and pilgrimage weeks do." The word Shavuot is the plural for the word Shavua, which is the Hebrew word for week, and Chag is a pilgrimage festival. Perhaps you've heard the phrase Chag Sameach. This phrase is traditionally said as glad tidings to one another, and it means happy pilgrimage festival. The majority of the time, when the word Chag occurs in the Hebrew text, it's translated into English as the word feast. In fact, it's the word feast that's used in Exodus chapter 23, verse 16 that we just read. There it says, V'chag ha-katzir, which is the feast of the harvest. There are numerous feasts of Adonai, but there are technically only three chagim. These are the ones that we've been reading about in these two passages. They are Unleavened Bread, Shavuot, and Sukkot, or Tabernacles. It is these three festivals in particular where the men of Israel are commanded to appear before Adonai in Jerusalem. Now, that is not to say that women weren't invited to these same festivals, but the men at a minimum were expected to be in Jerusalem three times a year for these three chagim, or pilgrimage festivals. The same instructions did not apply to Passover, First Fruits, Yom Teruah, or Yom HaKippurim. Of course, if one was expected to be in Jerusalem for Unleavened Bread, one would only naturally expect to be there for Passover, which coincides with and overlaps Unleavened Bread, and for First Fruits, which occurs during Unleavened Bread. And one would typically expect that one would have that Passover Seder with one's family. Thus, it was generally expected that the entire nation of Israel would show up in Jerusalem for at least the first Chag, Unleavened Bread. This, then, ties into the significance of the time frame that the Gospels lay out for us during what is referred to as the Passion Week, when Yeshua was tried, sentenced, killed, and resurrected. Virtually the entire nation of Israel would have been present in Jerusalem for those events. But that's another conversation for another time. Back to the topic at hand. If all these people were commanded to appear before Adonai in Jerusalem on these festival days, the logical question then arises. Where would they have stayed? They couldn't just show up, recognize the feast, and then split back out of town. Many of them came from places that took several days worth of walking to even get there. This is why we see Yeshua instruct the disciples to procure lodgings in an upper room in the Gospels, by the way. The answer to the question here is that they would have stayed in hotels, inns, and wherever else that they could procure lodgings, at which they would have paid money to the owners in order to stay there. Many of these festivals would have occurred on a weekly Shabbat. Shavuot would have always been the day after Shabbat. Shavuot literally starts as the sun sets on Shabbat. So in order to be there for Shavuot, one would have to have had already been there on Shabbat. In other words, in the case of the biblical festivals, the children of Israel were commanded to go to Jerusalem three times a year. They had to stay somewhere. In order to stay somewhere, they needed to pay for those lodgings. At those lodgings, there were things that needed to be tended to. Thus, a staff was being paid, just like in a hotel. Yet there are zero examples in the scripture of Adonai or one of his prophets speaking out against staying in a hotel during these events. In fact, we see Yeshua doing just that very thing in the Gospels. He ate his Last Supper with his disciples on either a Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday night, depending upon which source you rely upon and how they render those 3 days and nights that he was in the tomb. He was placed in the tomb. Israel then ate their Passover meals while he was in the tomb. Another conversation for another time. And then they had a commanded rest day, the first day of Unleavened Bread. Then after that, there was a Shabbat, and he arose from the tomb as the sun set on the weekly Shabbat. At the same time, the high priest was on the Mount of Olives, waving a sheaf of barley as the commanded first fruits wave offering. Do we think that Yeshua's disciples, on the day after the first rest day of Unleavened Bread, before the weekly Shabbat began, checked themselves out of the inn that they were staying at, slept in the streets, but stayed there in Jerusalem, so that they could then be there to witness the empty tomb on Sunday, the first day of the week? Or is it much more likely that they stayed in the lodgings that they had already procured? Now, I've belabored this point far enough. This entire situation is yet another Kal Vachomer scenario. The heavier, or the more important command to participate in the Chagim, the pilgrimage festivals, to have a Mikra Kodesh, a holy convocation with each other. The lighter, or less important command, is to not conduct business on the weekly Shabbat, and to let all your employees rest. Lest we assume to apply this principle to any other occasion, however, this scenario only unfolds in the case of a commanded festival of Adonai. But this explains why having a festival conference in a hotel is not only in line with Scripture, but in line with the witness of what we see being practiced in the life of Yeshua. That said, there are certain caveats that we should likely be aware of here. Just because we can justify the ability to pay for and stay in a hotel room on Shabbat if it falls during a biblical festival shouldn't then give us license to abuse this principle. As an example, while the hotel staff will still be working on Shabbat in order to meet the needs of the community, we shouldn't require them to meet our individual needs on these rest days. What I mean by that is that in order to keep in line with what we've already discussed in our previous episodes on this topic, we should make provisions in advance to ease the responsibility we force upon those who are out of covenant and who end up working on Shabbat in that hotel. As an example, we should do things like prepare our food in advance so we're not buying it from the hotel restaurant. It's entirely possible to pack food and bring it with you to these types of events. We should be making diligent plans to be the best stewards we can be for His name's sake. This means that we should go shopping the day we arrive to this type of conference, assuming that it's Friday, so that we can have food to consume on Shabbat the next day. Recognizing that the weekly Shabbat will occur during our stay, we should make necessary preparations. We should not abuse the solemnity of Adonai's feast as an excuse to take advantage of the loopholes in his rules. In this specific scenario, we should plan in advance, preparing whatever food is necessary, so we aren't forced to go purchase food on a Shabbat. Additionally, in this type of situation, we should do things like hang the Do Not Disturb sign on our hotel room door, so that the maids don't have to clean our rooms on Shabbat. Surely we don't need them to clean up after us after one day has passed. In all things, we should be cognizant and conscientious of those around us and do whatever it takes to be a blessing to those that are in a position where they're working to serve us in that specific scenario. Perhaps our behavior will be what sparks their curiosity about us and provokes them to begin asking questions about what it is that we believe and why we're doing what we're doing at that hotel. In all things, we should be a blessing to others and be a light to the nations. Let's set the right example and allow them to see how Yeshua shines in each one of us through our unique set-apart conduct that He might receive the glory. This should be our goal at all times, not just when we're at a special event like a biblical festival conference. And on that note, we come to an end of episode 5. Please join us again next week as we wrap up our conversation on the topic of Shabbat. Until then, shalom. If you enjoy this video, please hit the like button right here. And if you think this information would be beneficial for someone else, please hit the share button here. And please make sure your notifications are turned on so you receive an alert when a new video is posted. Thank you.